here we are. This is Sex, Love, Psychedelics, and I'm your host, Dr. Kat, bringing you psychosexual conversations that will leave you intellectually turned on and hungry for more.
Hey, lovers. Psychedelics are powerful motherfuckers as it relates to supporting our growth and evolution. We know this. However, we also know, if you've been listening to my podcast, that it is not the solution for our life to change. The urgency that we get to have a plant medicine session or ceremony might be alleviated at first, but the root of the issue doesn't change unless we put the effort in to change it. We are like these computers that we are running around on outdated operating systems that are about as old as we are, truthfully, only to have an experience of how smooth we can run without the glitches. And it's great. But in order to keep the latest version after the trial runs out, we've got to do the work. And what does the work even fucking mean? This is the time when the afterglow fades. You know, the glow after the ceremony fades. And if we aren't putting the efforts into redirecting the thoughts, redirecting the habits, you know, having a relationship with the parts of ourselves that want to protect and hold on to the armor, if we don't do that work of getting vulnerable and we're just clinging to the afterglow, or we're just clinging to ceremony after ceremony after ceremony, or we allow ourselves to get off with being a quote-unquote spiritual person that is better than everybody else because we have this insight that we got. We cling to the insight. Ha ha, this is the work. No. Sorry to break it to you, my loves, but it takes more than that. And I tell people who work with me for integration purposes only after their ceremony, that this is just the beginning. The devotion to acting, thinking, being different is a choice of a lifetime. Integration is a lifetime change or a change of lifestyle. Dr. Ida Cohen is here with me today to talk about the power of integration, why people struggle with it, and what golden nuggets you can extract so that you can support yourself in actual change, actual lasting change. But before we get to Dr. Ido, this coming May 2024, I will be leading Exhale, which is a femketamine retreat here in Malibu, California. And I'm sure you've heard a lot of different perspectives around what ketamine is or what it is not, or where to get ketamine at a rave. This isn't about that. I want to share with you how beautiful this medicine is when it is held with sacred reverence, intention, and a therapeutic lens. Because I've seen ketamine be able to help us access the sense of softness, the reference point of safety, the sense of I'm going to be okay in our bodies that perhaps we haven't been able to touch on because we've been riddled with so much anxiety, depression, and fear. I personally, as a facilitator, hold a strong, attentive, and powerful container. And I have witnessed profound states of insights, of resolution to treatment-resistant emotional pain, trauma, patterns of protection. I've seen and experienced full-blown energetic orgasms. I have had my own powerful insights with this medicine through therapeutic lens. And if you want to hear about the experiences that I personally had or what it's like to be in ketamine-assisted therapy around sensuality in couples, then check out my podcast episodes about this exact thing. I would love for you to be a part of this upcoming retreat, Exhale, with us. It's 4 days of deep dives, somatic practices, integration, and continuing community. I'm including the link to the landing page and application in the show notes. So definitely reach out to me if this is calling or if it's piquing your curiosity. I have already hopped on several calls with individuals who are interested, but they're not sure. There's something that's pulling them and they're curious. They have questions. And I want to open that invitation for you too. So link is in the show notes and hit me up. And now to Ido Cohen. Ido is a licensed psychotherapist from the Union perspective. He is the founder of the Integration Circle and facilitates workshops on the different dimensions of integration and the intersection of mental health, spiritual health, and the entheogenic experience. I'm so excited to have you on here for this conversation. It's going to be so juicy. I already felt it.
Thank you for inviting me, Kat. Yeah, I felt it too. It's been alive in my system for the last couple of days. So I'm very, very excited to talk to you.
Yeah, we didn't even push record and we were already giggling and we hadn't even said a word. We were already giggling. I was like, this is going to be good. Aliveness. That's the aliveness.
I was just about to say, you know, I think it'd be a good thing for us because you just named it. I was thinking about your podcast and I thought about what does Eros actually mean to me? You know, because a lot of what you talk about is erotic,
yes,
or de-erotic. And I think that's what, when you say aliveness, I'm like, yes, that's Eros. Anything that feels alive, right? So it can be a giggle. It can be something sad or something hard. It can be the sexual. It can be the other dimensional, the divine. So anything that feels alive.
But those are the yummy ones, right? But there's also like anger and there's repulsion and there's, you know, it's like passion.
Pain and suffering and hatred. And they're all, right, the different expressions of Eros energy.
Yeah. Yeah. Recently, I've been in this space of, I said something to my partner and I was just so full of like, rah! You know, like I'm feeling this about the situation, not about him, but about the situation. And I was like, wah, 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 wah. And he was like, wow, there's a lot of energy here. And I was like, whoa, like I'm feeling, and it was repulsion. It was the energetic of repulsion. And I was like, I don't want to look at that. Like, no, I want it away from me. I don't want anything. And then as soon as that came out of my mouth, I was journaling this morning and I was like, oh, damn, that's got the energy. That's the aliveness. I need to be with that, but I don't want to.
Well, that's a beautiful piece of integration you did there with yourself.
Yeah, you know, and that actually brings it full circle to what I want to start here, because on your page, which I'm going to encourage everybody to start following you on Instagram, because you have such profound nuggets of wisdom in your posts and just some really good quality of things to sit with and reflect on. And there was one in there. And it was a meme and it said, babe, are you okay? You've been having insights for months, but you've barely touched your integration. And the playful part in me knows, like, I've been seeing these memes, you know, where it's like, "Mary, why haven't you touched your dinosaur mashed potatoes or something?" You know, right. and it's like the word integration, you know, here in this playfulness has almost become a buzzword in the psychedelic lexicon, yeah. And yet I'm wondering if the lack of integration is because there's a lack of truly understanding what it could be, not what necessarily what it is, but what it could be, because integration, I also can see it as this multifaceted definition of what people, you know, see.
Absolutely.
But what could it be and how could it be applied for people to anchor onto? How would you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, right, there's, like you said, it's multifaceted, right? We can talk about, you and I touched upon that integration actually starts in before the experience, right? So integration starts in preparation, because how I prepare will impact what shows up for me, and how I navigate the experience will impact what comes after, which is the integration piece, right? But we talk mostly about integration as like a post-experience process. And the way I think about integration is really, it's an ongoing process of taking your experience and creating the long-term sustainable change. Key word here is sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because we can have peaks of change or bursts of change or catharsis, but then it kind of dissipates or fades out after a while.
Kind of like going, like using what we were saying a moment ago about this aliveness, this eros. It's almost like taking the potency of aliveness here, and then how can you create the aliveness continuing rather than letting it completely die?
Relationship.
Yeah.
Relationship. If you think about it, anything that has aliveness in it comes in relations to something. So I'm going to take your example. You felt repulsion.
Yeah.
Right? You're feeling it. It just ran through you. And the moment your partner kind of mirrored it to you, you're like, you came into relationship with it, right? There is me and then there is repulsion.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, ugh, I don't want to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's then in that moment, that's the nature of the relationship. It's one of disconnect or repressant or something. And then you did this beautiful piece. And you're like, no, I actually really want to be in relationship with that. That is the important thing. So for me, integration is all about the relationship. It's what kind of relationship are you going to have with your experience?
Mm.
And if you want to take it one step deeper, I have a running theory that I will test one day, or like that it actually, how we relate to our experience is a mirror of our attachment system, right? Because if I have a big experience and I stay with it for 2 weeks, and then after 2 weeks, I repress it, I neglect it, I detach from it, it's probably a mirror of how I do things that happen in other relationships, where I meet something really precious. What's my ability to stay related to it?
Oof, yeah.
Right?
I just want to bring to the awareness of all of our listeners, if you felt that in your body, maybe focus on that for a moment.
Have a relationship with that sensation. Right? So integration is about building a relationship. It's ongoing. It's about opening, right? For me, integration is really about asking a lot of questions to keep opening, because then the psychedelic experience continues. So I can go through all, right, the four dimensions of experience, which is the somatic, the psychological, emotional, spiritual. What happened to me? Where is there a lot of energy? Maybe there was feelings of repulsion. Maybe there was feeling of eros. Maybe there was feeling of, you know, I revisited an old trauma, or I saw a vision, or I had an archetypal encounter, or that's where I want to start being in inquiry with. And then, right, I can sit with an encounter with an archetype and be like, okay, what happened when I saw that serpent who was coming and, I don't know, trying to devour me, or telling me that's a very common, right? Or like trying to bite me, or was I scared? Was I relieved? Was I hopeful? Was I inspired? What happened after? There's so much we can do if we open up that relationship, if we slow down and open it up. And in a way, one of my things is like you're bringing some kind of erotic sensual dimension to your experience, because it's about slowing down. It's about getting in touch with. It's about feeling. It's about sensing. As opposed to, wow, I had this big experience, let me make conclusions about it, right? It means this.
Yeah, very intellectual.
It's intellectual. It's also, for me, it's residual of our capitalistic complex of, I've experienced something, you understand it fast, you move on, you create something from it. As opposed to what you and I are talking about, which is like, no, how about you take your time? How about you let it unfold? How about you let it open? Right. So it's both capitalism. And it's also, I think, it's just a very, it's a common side effect of suffering.
Mm.
If I'm suffering and I go into an experience and it offers me a way out of suffering, I will take it. But sometimes we do that too fast. Right.
Yeah.
This is where I heard you speak about this. You said, the only time a psychedelic experience feels like 10 years of therapy is because you had 10 years of therapy before that.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I think for me, it's the same. It's like, right. It's an echo of that. It's this wish that we have for some kind of panacea, some kind of something that will take us out of suffering.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me of, I recently had somebody, somebody say to me, I just want to be, I recognize that I want to be saved. And, you know, and my response to that was, yeah, there's a part of us that all wants to be saved.
Absolutely.
You know, that's such a shared collective experience of we're in the pain. And I know for me, that showed up. I had a terrible gut issues for years, you know, and could not find, I went to every doctor, I went to every, you know, did everything to figure it out. And it wasn't until I was doing some of the deeper trauma work that I was able to alleviate that with a lot of cold plunging and you know, like going into the thing, but realizing, you know, like how I was interacting with this, and I'll use the word archetype and deconstruct that, but this archetype of the savior and how I'm looking through my doctors or through the medicine work or through, even my own therapist. But then at the end of the day, I still had to learn to self-regulate. I still had to learn how to relax my body, still had to go into the pain of the cold plunge at 42 degrees to do that work where my body would find the calmness and I would find the peace.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one way we could think about that is that you had to build a relationship with the archetype in you that wants to be saved.
Oof. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Because usually, or if James Hillman talks about that, archetypes always work in pairs. So whenever I'm in my child, you're going to be the opposite that I need you to be. So I've been my child and I'm in my mother complex, you're going to be my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If I'm in my child and I'm going to be the helpless child, you're going to be my savior. So I'm going to look at you and approach you from that place. So whenever I'm feeling an archetype, the opposite is in the room somewhere or out there in the world, right? In this case, it can be psychedelics, or it can be the female or male shaman, right? They're going to save me or my therapist or this method or that thing, right? And it's okay to do that, right? But we hope, like what you beautifully described, to get to a point where I'm like, oh, wait, I have to become the savior. Now, it doesn't mean I stop using all these beautiful tools, all these beautiful people on this networks of support. We need them. We can't do this alone, but we want to build a relationship with that archetype. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And how would you define for our audience what archetype means so they can anchor into that?
Yeah. So archetypes, as I understand them, are energetic entities that are both rooted in our personal psyche, but are also totally independent, right? So Jung talked about the collective unconscious. So the collective unconscious is the realm of everything that is shared in humanity and beyond, that's beyond race, beyond culture, right? So if you go, the most easy way to explain it is, if we will travel anywhere in the world and we will ask people to describe mother, every tribe, every culture will have an idea of mother, even if they're never met. And if we will look at these descriptions, we will find something in common. So, right, he said that those commonalities are from the fact that we all share a psychic space that is the collective unconscious. Now, the deeper collective unconscious is the thing that connects us to, it's where dreams come from. It's where we connect in psychedelics to ancestry, to other dimensions, and in the collective unconscious, leave the archetype. Now, the big thing with archetypes is archetypes have been really intellectualized when Jung kind of became mainstream. So it's like, oh, they become like looking at a picture. And Jung talks about it a lot, that archetypes have to be felt. If you don't feel it, you're not really there with them. So you have to feel them. You have to feel them emotionally, and you have to feel them in your body, right? So the mother archetype can be my personal mother. But if I go deep enough, I will also connect to the mother archetype, right? The big mother archetype. So it'd be some kind of, we'll start finding roots in some goddess or some deity or Gaia or the earth or something like that, right? But it's really about, it's knowing to do the inquiry. So when I meet, I'll give an example. I had a personal experience of being in an ayahuasca ceremony and having this black fire, you know, like with all these flames surrounded, Buddha show up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was magnificent and terrifying at the same time. And I had a freeze response. My response was, I froze. And I heard this voice saying, did you notice what you just did? And I was like, yeah, I froze. And what I experienced as the archetype, this Buddha was like, but why? This is just my appearance. It's not who I am. And I was like, oh, that's true. And then the whole conversation became about the ways in which I had fear of what I would call the feminine, this powerful, beautiful, wise, wild feminine energy that just showed up through this Buddha archetype. And it was a whole conversation. And I saw in myself the ways in which my personal psychology was carrying fear that mm-hmm. I was then projecting onto women.
Mm-hmm.
But I also saw that in that fear, in my personal psyche, there is roots in the feminine, which is feminine is the unexpected. It's mm-hmm. the surprising. It's the uncontrollable. It's process. It's mystery. It's the formless. And I had to look at my relationship with that. And I was like, wow, that is terrifying mm-hmm. for me in some way. I love it. I seek it. Obviously, I'm here. I put myself in a psychedelic state where I'm going into the formless.
Uh-huh.
But there is also a part of me that's scared. And why?
Of course. Yeah. Right. So this is interesting to hear, you know, the archetype of the mother. You said the personal mother mm-hmm. and then the mother, you know, and he's doing exactly. a big old arm wave over here. to pick that. For individuals who, you know, aren't familiar with this or perhaps are new in the concept of introspection, you know, mm-hmm. which is really important for psychedelics or in my opinion for effective work here, how would you describe to somebody when you drop from the personal relationship with the archetype to the,
the transpersonal, the collective.
Yeah. I was like primordial, existential
primordial,
archetype.
Yeah, absolutely. Primordial, mythopoetic, mythological. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the exercise I do with people in the courses that I teach is I have people write, first of all, just free associate to the word mother.
Mm-hmm.
So you just free associate, don't think. So you write, mother is warm, aggressive, kind, caring, food, right? All these things. And usually certain words will show up that if you think about them are not related to your mother.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it can be unconditionally loving or... And it's then we can start wondering like, oh, wait, where's this coming from?
Mm-hmm.
Now, usually most of us have, when we let ourselves go, we start discovering that we have the wish for the archetype. So when what I didn't get from my mother, I wish from some other mother, and usually it's from that archetype. So I wish for a mother who every time that I felt bad would come and hold me and reassure me and stare me right in the eyes and soothe me. And she will be totally attuned, totally understanding. Mm-hmm. That's not a human character, right? No mother can be that all the time. It's impossible.
Right.
That is the archetype expressing itself, the desire for the archetype. I think an easier one for people might be when you think about partnership.
Yeah.
Right. If you asked anyone, like, write what you want in your ideal partner.
Mm-hmm.
But really let yourself go, right? You see this whole list of they are kind and warm and funny and always understanding. And this is where you're kind of projecting, right? You're connecting, you're projecting the lover archetype onto an ideal partner.
Yeah.
This is where most of us are starting to feel the reality bite us in the butt when we get into a relationship because all those projections start falling apart.
Right.
So which means that the archetypal projection is falling and I'm staying with the person. So yeah, Kat is funny and smart and intelligent and this, but she's not always understanding. And sometimes she feels repulsed and she has strong feelings. And I don't know about that, right? I'm just using you.
Yeah.
Right? So that is my archetypal projection. So I have to start separating the right? I have to withdraw and take back those projections, the archetypal projections, and work with the human. And why am I projecting that on you? Usually we project on people the things that we are either severely lacking because of our upbringing, or that are part of ourself that we give to other people. So I will make you the powerful or make you the most horrible because it's part of my own shadow that I want to negate. Or the pieces in you that I need to integrate in myself for my own healing. Right? Meaning if I have a really hard time regulating, I will want Kat, my partner, to be really good at that.
Yeah.
Because then she can do it for me. Because I can't do that for myself. So that's where, to your question, like I think where the archetypal and the personal kind of intersects. Right. And that's on the personal level. But then we have the collective level, which is.
And go ahead and go into that.
Well, you know, I think that the for the collective, we're talking about archetypes of the collective. So that's racism, capitalism, patriarchy, sexism, all the big isms, war. Those are archetypes that live inside of us all the time. Right. I was just talking to someone yesterday as a preparation for an experience. And she's working through aging. Now, mind you, she is 50. She looks wonderful. She's aware of how she looks. But the impact of her culture, she's not American, and of the standard of beauty for women and how it's tied to their self-worth. So those archetypes are so deep in her that she can see it, but she's like, but now that I look in the mirror, all I see is that one wrinkle. And it makes me feel like I'm losing my value, right? So that's how those collective things play in our personal. So how does racism play inside of my psyche? Can I be, and again, I think the big question for whoever's listening is, can I be in relationship with it? Can I ask the forbidden questions like, am I racist? Do I have biases? Because if I can't, the archetypal energy is going to work me as opposed to working together.
Which is so challenging for so many people who don't have tools to be able to hold themselves with some of those answers. You know, there's this, so it's like we've created this, I think this is a nature of humanity to have this type of thinking that's black or white or this or that. And the psychedelic consciousness is being able to hold two seemingly opposite things that can coexist at the same time. Can I recognize and not over-identify? There may be a part of me that feels that is racist, or there is a part of me that goes to war with other people's ideologies or ways of being in the world, and that doesn't make me this full identity of this thing.
Yes. Yeah. Jung talked about it as holding the tension of opposites, right? That nature works. If you look at nature, nature works in, it always harmonizes opposites, right? There's destruction and creation. Death and life, right? An animal kills another animal, but it sustains itself through in order to live further so that the other animal can create life. So there's always opposites. And I think you named maybe the core of what all of us need to know how to do in order to actually change, which is to hold opposites. But I always talk to people that when you go to a psychedelic experience, you are getting a new experience that's then entering into your old life. That's a pair of opposites. A lot of the time, psychedelic experiences, any meaningful experiences, the relationship with them falls apart because they don't fit into the old.
Yeah.
So we can't hold that tension. I can't let that tension work on me, which is basically being an alchemist. I can't let these two substances, I have to be the container for the old and the new to start finding their way into a merger. So they can create a new consciousness. But I am the container, right? And that's really hard because if I have a new experience, I'll take a very classical one. I work with so many people who through psychedelics or groups or all of a sudden have this re-emerging consciousness around boundaries, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God, I didn't know that I didn't put boundaries and now I want to put boundaries. Great. And then they have to go home and start being the person who's putting boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people, you're laughing, right? Because then all your system knows you as this weak, boundaryless person. And then everybody, your system starts responding to you. It's like, wait, what do you mean? No.
Yeah.
What do you mean you want to have time for yourself? What do you mean you want to, what I said to you doesn't work for you and you need me to think about how I treat you, right? So then there's tension.
Yeah, yeah. Which
and
may...
our job is to hold, right? Be the container for that tension. Like, oh, crap, like Kat is having feelings because I'm practicing boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's terrifying for me. But yeah. Can I stay with my boundaries and now work with this new experience, which is me being boundaried and Kat having feelings, but we're staying in connection.
Yeah. And where so many of us were not shown models of how to be a container. That's where I feel so strongly about, you know, you quoted me 10 years of therapy. I'm going to quote you because you said something very similar. And it's funny. I laughed this morning. I was like, we're talking about the same thing. And your perspective on it was if you're liking the psychedelic experience to 10 years of therapy, then you've done bad therapy. Yeah, because I believe that therapy is a place where we can learn to be our own container. We don't necessarily know how to contain or hold our emotions or, you know, and a therapist can be that model for us so we can fully fall apart and they're holding us. And from there we learn, oh, okay, I can pick back up. Oh, I can self-regulate. Oh, I can sit with myself. And so it's like, for all the people who are just going out and to psychedelic experiences, beautiful. However, here's the integration process of, you know, support. What's your support on either side?
Mm-hmm. And I think you're naming two big things for me, which is before there's integration, there is disintegration by definition. Before true transformation integration can happen, something has to disintegrate. So for me to learn how to be my own container, like you said, if I come to do therapy with you, you're going to be my container so I can fall apart. So I can understand, wait, why have I never been my container all this? I have to like have that that very loose structure disintegrate so I can build a new one with your help. And I think that's where there's a lot of, like you said, miseducation, because nobody teaches us how to do that. And there's also a lot of bypassing with psychedelics, which is, I say this to people, you can't change and be the same at the same time. You can't go and have a psychedelic experience and expect no disruptions. You know, I took this from a colleague of mine who she asks people before they do a psychedelic experience, are you and your life in a good enough place to maybe fall apart? And nobody thinks about what happens if the psychedelic really shakes me? Am I in a good enough psycho-emotional spiritual place? Is my relationship in a good enough space? Is my living conditions in a good enough space for me to really dive into transformation?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing you and I kind of chatted about that feels meaningful to this is to hold those opposites, to go through this in disintegration, we have to know how to grieve.
Oh, yes.
So let's talk about grief a little bit.
Okay, let's go there.
Right? Because there's varying degrees, but grief is about having a level of acceptance of a loss, but also realizing that just because I lost a person, a job, a way of seeing myself, a way of understanding life, doesn't mean that the knowledge I took from it, the love that was there, the relationship is gone too. I think that's for me the big difference between mourning something and grieving something.
Mm.
When you mourn something, there is still a negotiation with the loss. You're saying, no, I'm not willing to accept that this is gone. And there is an attached idea that if it's gone, it's gone. The love is gone, the relationship is gone, the experience is gone. There is a total like annihilation of the whole thing. As opposed to, no, you know, she was a beautiful partner for me for 10 years. And I have a library of knowledge and life experiences and love for this person. And we're not going to be together. And that was, that hurts, and it's painful, and it's shattering, and you can be depressed about it, and you can be sad about it. But there is a deep level of acceptance, and the acceptance allows for Eros to come in. Because when I'm not accepting, I'm fighting Eros off. I'm like, no, I don't want to feel what it means to like fully lose this person.
Mm-hmm. And that's draining to stay in that state.
Say more.
It takes a lot of energy to fight, you know, these parts of us, to manage the parts inside of us, you know, whether we're protecting ourselves from the pain of the thing or the reality of what is versus, you know, finding the, you know, grieving and crying and heaving and you know, being in that space, which actually allows it to like a wave come up and then recede again.
That's such a good point. Yeah, it takes so much energy, so much energy. And there's this idea that there's two types of suffering. There is neurotic suffering and authentic suffering, right? And the idea that neurotic suffering keeps you in the same place. Authentic suffering allows for change to happen. So I'm thinking about what you just said, how much energy it takes, right? How many of us at this moment are in a way refusing to accept some version of suffering that we have, but investing so much energy in not accepting it? Like, no, I refuse to believe that it's this way. And to bring, I think, like, I love that you're saying it, to bring empathy to it. It's like, yeah, because we're protecting ourselves from a deeper level of feeling. What if I, because if I accept it, I have to weep in bed for a week. But how do I remember that that's Eros too, that is actually life running through me, right? That those tears are what alchemically we call solutio. Those are the tears that bring movement, that move things, they liquefy the stagnant. They allow for things to move from solid to liquid to something else.
Mm.
As opposed to, I'm just destroyed and devastated and this is depression. And obviously that was a wrong idea or the wrong choice or, right, starting to make all kinds of future predictions based on my feeling of this moment.
Mm-hmm. You know how many clients that I work with around sexuality have a lot of grief, unprocessed grief in their bodies, that their bodies are tense and holding. And and it's once they go into the falling apart that they start being able to access pleasure and access orgasmic states because they're not tensing as much to contain that. You know, like what you said, we don't have a relationship with grief in this culture. Mm-hmm. It's like, we got to keep going. We got to, you know, get back on it. We don't have the time to do that. But we forget, you know, all the things in our life that we need to grieve. It's not just the relationship that was 10 years long. It's also the grief that happens after breakthroughs, you know, the loss of the ways that we operated before. I used to work out like a fiend. Can't do that anymore. And part of it's because I've healed my nervous system and I just, my body doesn't want that anymore. Mm-hmm. It can't do that.
There's two things I want to pick up there because they're so, the grief that comes from positive change, right? From transformation, that's such an important piece. Because it's true, we lose something no matter which direction, right? Even if I'm changing my life for the best, it means I might stop hanging out with this person or letting go of that habit that I had. And can I allow myself to grieve? Because some other version of myself really needed it. So can I honor that version that needed that distraction, that needed that soothing, that needed that dissociation as I'm transforming into the next evolution of myself. Mm-hmm. And there's something really beautiful about that. It feels very integrated for me.
Mm.
You know, I was just in a conversation last week with someone about, she was talking about how she is just fed up with her maiden self. It's like, that's it. I loved her, but I'm done with her. Like she carries my pain. I just want to be done with. And I was like, wait. That feels important. If you're throwing her out because you're going to feel less pain, you're throwing all of her out. And we're not acknowledging why she had to do, because she's carrying your pain. That's why she had to have all these behaviors, not because she's bad.
Mm.
Right? So we don't want to shame ourselves on the way to healthy transformation. It's like, oh, whatever, that part of me was just bad. It's like, no. That part of you has a whole history and a lot of reasons why it did what it did. Can we honor it in our grief?
Mm-hmm.
And my question, I'm curious if you can, because I am curious about this tie between grief and sexuality.
Yeah.
Right. I can say like, yes, of course, if the body is constrained, if the soul is constrained from unprocessed loss, how will the eros come in? You know, like how will we celebrate first, second chakra centers? But can you say more about that? I'm really curious.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll speak of in a few different ways. So one, I hear this a lot with clients, as well as I was working with somebody who was writing a piece about the ties of grief and sex, and how for many people, there's the pattern of a surge of erotic energy when they're grieving, because, and there can be many reasons. It could be aliveness, you know, that feeling, I'm feeling something, I'm feeling emotion. It also breaks us open and we're softer, we're more vulnerable. And that can be really magnetic. I remember after the time of my dad passing, for a few months after, not immediately after, but for the few months after, I was a lot more magnetic to partners, to sexual partners. And there was the part of me that felt, you know, I felt so soft and vulnerable, and I could melt into people more easily. And it also, you know, getting to sit with, is this, you know, how is this acting as an archetype for me of safety, or of, you know, like giving me reprieve? Or is this, you know, it could also be this creative force that comes from, you know, when you soften into flow and soften into that, it's super attractive, you know? Mm-hmm. But then it can also go the other route of, grief can also kill our libido, and it can, because it can take all of us in order to do that process. And I don't think that there's a right or a wrong. It's just bringing conscious awareness. Like you said, I loved that, building a relationship with these, with what we're observing in ourselves and what's happening.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with both of those. And that's a really, I'll have to think about it more later. but yeah, I think there's a group in Spain that did a study on grief and ayahuasca, and how ayahuasca can help process deep emotions of grief and move us from mourning into grief.
Mm-hmm. From our tantric perspective, because that's one of my lineages, there is also using erotic energy as a alchemical process for grief and pain. And so there's the intentional use of eros, of sexual energy, of pleasure, of turn on to process as well, which makes sense on the somatic level, because it is, you know, it is orgasm is a release of the body. And, you know, we can cry in orgasm. It's not even necessarily the genital contractions. It's the body contractions. It's the energetic contractions and shivers that can help us to process too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you're making me think as I'm listening to you, I'm like, well, it brings me back to our thing about opposites, right? Is there a way that we live in a construct, or there is something about our consciousness that can be worked through, where grief and joy are not opposites? I can be grieving and experiencing joy at the same time.
Yeah. Ayahuasca reminds me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You would do that a lot, because I think a lot of psychedelics open us up so much, our conscious, to see like, oh, you think you're sad, but you actually are also happy and you're actually also grateful. And there's all these things that are happening, but we're all carrying like potentially societal, familial structures where like, if you're sad, you're sad. You can't be joyful. You know, I'm Jewish. So for us, when someone dies, there is a very particular set of rituals. And in the first year, you don't celebrate. You don't get married. There's no like events. And there is, now that we're talking about it, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. There is something in that that is a prohibition on joy as a way to honor the dead, as though if I am enjoying myself, I'm not honoring them, right? And maybe there is something about, to be curious about our pairs of opposites. Like, yeah, I can be grieving, but I can also have sex and enjoy it. I can also go and be with people that I love and experience happiness and still grieve at the same time.
And it's not a betrayal of yourself, The part of you that is grieving. Yeah.
Of yourself, of the person, of the process of anything. Yeah.
Oof. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's beautiful. You know, there's so much seductive quality to analyzing and thinking and you know, being with in the symbol and the mythological. Like, I could stay in here and just get off on this topic. Using that metaphor from earlier. At what point does it become maladaptive, or can it become maladaptive to stay in that space, or rather than supportive? Like, is there a tipping point of that?
To stay in the space of exploration, in the space of...
Maybe that's the key, like the difference between intellectualization and maturation, or, you know, being with these parts.
I think that when you move from just intellect to feeling, sensing, imagining, the image, the archetype, the experience starts to change.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if I move from like, oh, I'm thinking about the archetype and I'm going and I'm reading the Book of Symbols and I'm researching and I'm like thinking about it really, and I'm to wait, how does it feel? So I'm thinking about a client of mine who went to an ayahuasca experience and turned into a wolf, and he was running with a pack of, right? And it was so seductive to be like, okay, tell me about your associations about wolves. And he was doing wolf research. But then I was like, wait, how did it feel in your body to be a wolf? And he was like, oh, it was the most liberating experience I've ever had. I felt so powerful. And that opened up actually a lot of sadness, because he felt incredibly powerless in his life. So the image shifted from intellect to sadness to power. Like, literally his homework was to go home and embody. Like, I was like, go embody a wolf. If you need to go out and run, go out and run. If you want to like be on all fours in your room and feel it, like go back into the image, great. Let the image move through you. Let the image evolve. So the idea is that archetypes are evolving, and you never know how. You know, we did in one of our courses, when I teach archetypes, I randomly assign archetypes to people, and they have to go through a process. And one of our groups, the most really intellectual person there got the archetype of water, and he automatically started thinking about water. And like, look, the next time we met, he said, I have to tell you a story. He's like, since I got that, the next day I've had diarrhea for 2 weeks. And he said that it took him a week, and he was on the toilet having diarrhea. And all of a sudden he had this like realization. He's like, oh, I am stuck in my intellect, and this is forcing me to be in my body and feel discomfort and feel what it means to take care of myself. It snapped him out of his mind, and he realized how much he was living in his intellect. So that's a great example of how an archetype evolves in these really unexpected ways. Mm-hmm. And he got it. He saw it as like this wonderful cosmic humor that the archetype is throwing at him. It's like, oh, you thought you're going to go and look at images and research. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you're going to sit on the toilet and experience water through you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. The cosmic humor. It's like the way to sit with the hilarity and the pain at the same time.
You know, it's that beautiful wish that may you get what you need and not what you want. You know, it's like, it's the archetypes like psychedelics will always give you what you want, and hopefully they'll give you a lot of what you need to really get to your next step of integration and wholeness.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's something I've been sitting with, and this will probably be the last point that we touch on before we wrap up. But, you know, I hear a lot of stories about people's psychedelic journeys, and I believe that there is so much power in storytelling, and that it can support our collective healing. But I also hear from people, because some of these experiences are like, oh, you know, like I channeled divine became Dionysus, or I became, you know, and then people listening to the podcast and being like, well, I haven't reached that yet, so therefore there's something wrong with me, or I want to have those states of consciousness too. I want to channel. And so how can we hold space for storytelling, both helping while also recognizing that I don't know, like be aware of how it can create feelings. I think
it goes back to relationships, right? If I'm listening to you telling me that you became a Delphi Oracle and you're channeling the gods.
Which I totally have.
Great.
No, I'm kidding.
I would love to hear about it at some point.
next podcast.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yes, please. Let's talk about that. And my first response to you is jealousy. That is my work. That is my, here it is. Here's my shadow work. What a wonderful opportunity for me to keep processing my shadow. Why do it? And then if you want to go further, it's like, oh, wow, I'm jealous. I'm jealous because why? Why do I want to become a Delphi Oracle and experience? I want to experience the divine because I feel disconnected. Great. Here's your clue. You don't need to go take another dose of ayahuasca to become a Delphi Oracle. You're seeking connect. Start seeking that connection. So I think there is, it's really a, for me, it's all these ways are good mirrors to the unprocessed shadow we have. And I think it's also a good mirror to, again, our suffering. I've had that too. Don't get me. I remember my first experience ever was for me very shattering, but beautiful. And I remember this person next to me was talking about how she was conversing with a dragon the whole night and it was the most blissful. And there was a part of me, it's like, I didn't get that cup. Like, why did I not get that? What did you get? I wanted the same, right? And then it took me a while to be like, wait, why am I running away from my experience searching for someone else?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or why aren't we willing to do the integration work, full circle back to our first conversation, to be in a state where I can access, you know, where I can channel. I mean, it takes a lot of work. It takes years of work to be able to do that and devotion to the craft. Rather than I want to be there now, and so I'm going to do 10 ayahuasca ceremonies in a row to get there, to be.
And the last piece I would say that I think it's also because we lost the idea of a village model of learning, which is we learn from each other. So if you became the Oracle of Delphi, I want to know what you got. Like, what wisdom are you bringing back? Because in that moment, I'm in connection with the Oracle of Delphi. I don't need to become that.
Yeah.
Right. So we forgot that we sit in a village. We're here to learn from each other, not to be jealous and envious of each other's experience, which cuts off learning.
Oh, God, that's so good. Let that one sit. Wow. How can people find more about you? How can they study with you? I'm asking for a friend, not for myself personally, aka I'm asking for myself personally.
I have my project. It's called The Integration Circle. So you can find us on Instagram and our website or myself on Instagram. I teach with Psychedelics Today in their Vital year long. And we also have a standalone course on shadow that we just wrapped up and we're starting a new cohort. If you want to go deeper into really understanding Jungian and transpersonal perspectives on shadow work in psychedelics. And I also work with Double Blind. I'm their integration facilitator. So we do, every month we do kind of a talk about integration. And if we're already here, I don't know when this is going to drop, but we're doing a free workshop for couples, people who want to do psychedelics together as a couple. So how to prepare more consciously, navigate and integrate more consciously.
I love this. Yes, yes. We ran out of time, but this concept of group integration versus individual integration, what's the benefit of that? Oof. How do you see that? Might be another podcast.
That is another. I think group integration can be really good for de-shaming. So you're seeing that, wait, other people have the exact same story as me. The exact same feelings. I'm not alone. I'm not uniquely bad or messed up or anything, like any judgment that comes. The village model of learning, you can get so much from other people's experience that then you take with you. And you get to build connections. A lot of people who do psychedelics feel very lonely. You know, I think we're very privileged to live in environments that are probably very, offer a lot of support and a lot of opportunity for connection. But I get from a lot of people how lonely they feel. They come to our groups and they're like, oh my God, it's so good to feel connected to people who are not just going through psychedelics, but are thinking about it in a nuanced way, are really trying to live and integrate those knowledge, those experiences in the way they are showing up day to day. So I think that's just, you know, off the top of my head, that's the big advantages of group work, but it can also be overwhelming for certain people. Certain people have traumas around group. Groups actually make them shut down. So you need to know where you are with groups before you do that. And feel out what feels the right thing for you.
Yeah. And to find a facilitator who feels good, resonant in your body, absolutely. Who contributes to consent and doesn't force a process on you. I hear that a lot.
We can talk a lot about facilitator abuse and misuse.
Great. Come back. We'll be friends.
I would love to.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This is beautiful.
Thank you so much, Kat.
Well, that was fun. Thanks for tuning in, lovers. And if you want to experience more ecstasy and sexual liberation, head over to sexlovepsychedelics.com and learn about how you can join me for any one of my online or live events. And while you're there, grab my free guide on sex and psychedelics. Remember, this podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Please contact your healthcare provider and local law before pursuing any of the products or psychedelics discussed. And one final note here. I make this show specifically for you. If you're loving the show, then be sure to leave me a review in iTunes or Spotify to let me know. Happy to be here and happy to serve. I'll see you next time on Sex, Love, Psychedelics.